It was a royal wedding weekend and Britain was enjoying a public holiday. At their home in the English Midlands, a Chinese family, the Dings, joined in the celebrations. They had made Britain their home.
They opened a Chinese medicine shop and they had three shops across the UK. And that was quite successful, and that represented that we're doing well financially and that they were quite proud of their businesses.
The Dings had set up a partnership with another Chinese family.
Ang Chengdu and his wife came to this country from China in 1998. They were both doctors of traditional Chinese medicine. And they started a family, and after a short while, they met the Dings. She was a businesswoman, and he was a lecturer at university in Manchester.
But all was not what it seemed between the couples. The picture-perfect Ding family were about to be killed. One by one. The eldest daughter desperately phoning police for help as her assassin walked towards her.
It was the kind of thing that just makes your blood run cold in your veins. You know, it's that thing where you forget to breathe, where you are chilled throughout your whole body, and you just think, I'm witnessing somebody die a violent death. There's nothing to describe the horror when you know what those screams represent and what those poor children were going through.
Detectives gather evidence until a picture of a suspect emerges. Which piece of the puzzle will reveal An Xiangdu as guilty of murder? What would be a killer's mistake? The scene, which met officers as they arrived at the home of the Ding family in a quiet English village, was horrific.
My reaction was incredulity because not so much in the sense that two adults had been murdered. I mean, sadly, you know, we all know that happens. I think the ferocity of the attack, the fact that it was a knife-related killing with multiple stab wounds, blood everywhere. But I think the thing that tipped it over the edge for me was the slaying of the two girls in the upstairs bedroom. To go and kill two defenceless girls cowering in their bedroom in their own home, beggars belief.
Xing and Alice Ding, both talented violinists, quite literally knew what was coming. Their attacker had begun with their father.
He confronts Jeff Ding, produces his knife, and attacks him. Jeff Ding tries to fight off the attack, to ward off the stab wounds, sustains defense wounds to his hands, and Jeff Ding dies of these stab wounds.
The attack was in the kitchen of the house. Jeff Ding's killer had only just begun.
It's believed that Helen Ding hears the commotion in the kitchen and she comes in, and Du immediately attacks her. She has no defense wounds, she hasn't had time to shield herself from the blows, but she's stabbed 13 times down the left side of her body. Fatal blows. He's killed them both, but he's not finished. He then turns his attention to their two daughters.
One 18, one just 12, and mercilessly and brutally front of each other, stabbed them to death.
Before she died, the oldest Ding daughter managed to use her mobile phone to call the police.
It came to light that there was a telephone call that was made, horrifically enough, from one of the girls who had a mobile phone. So they tried to ring the police, and it went through on the 999 system. But it's what they call a dropped call. So when the emergency operator received the call, they just heard some screams on the end of the phone, and then the call dropped because it ended.
Events elsewhere had an influence on the possibilities of why the call had been made.
It was bank holiday afternoon, so I think there was an element that people thought it was some kind of prank or holiday high spirits. Nevertheless, the police were sent to the location that was indicated from mobile phone tracking that goes with a 999 call. But unfortunately, because of the nature of that tracking, the police were sent to the wrong location. So we know from that phone call, which we received at about just after 3:30 in the afternoon, that was when the murders were taking place, somewhere around the 3:30 mark. But the girls never got to make their request for assistance.
Phone tracking is not an exact science.
So it took the officers to a location at least a mile distant from where the actual murders had occurred. And of course, having turned up and there's nothing here and there doesn't appear to be any problem, would probably, you know, add to this idea that, oh, it's just a prank call. Sadly, you know, the 999 service, fire, ambulance and police do get prank calls. This, chillingly, was not. This was a real call, and those were probably the last human sounds that those two poor girls made.
There can be little doubt that the Ding family will have screamed. But neighbours heard nothing. Their home overlooked a landscaped area free from other properties. It's probable that within minutes of An Xiangdu arriving at the house in Pioneer Close, all four had been killed.
The daughters were found upstairs in their bedrooms. One of the daughters was curled up in a ball. You get stabbed repeatedly, especially in the stomach. It's extremely painful, so maybe she was curled up in a ball because she was in so much pain, and she then lost consciousness in that position. Another of the daughters was found in a prayer position.
With all four dead, the killer had completed what appeared to be a mission, wiping out an entire family.
What we now know that he did was that, having murdered the family in cold blood, he washed the murder weapon, a knife, and his hands, and left it at the sink. I think the court records will say that he then felt some kind of physical reaction to having committed the murders and actually slept for a while at the house where the murders had been committed.
The slaying of the Ding family was over by 3:30 on the afternoon of Friday, April 29th. 42 hours would pass before their slaughter would be uncovered. Time enough for their killer to be a long way from the scene of their murder. Detectives know that most murders are carried out by someone who knows the victim well. Suspecting someone is, however, a far cry from having the evidence to prove a case. Seasoned investigators tend towards routine when trying to first find and then see a killer convicted. That routine, generally, starts with getting a phone call. The man who would lead the hunt for the killer of the Ding family is Glyn Timmins. He too was enjoying the royal wedding bank holiday when he heard of their death.
On the night of the 1st of May, when the murders came to light, my colleague was the on-call senior investigating officer for Northamptonshire, and he'd been sent to the discovery of bodies at a house in the Wootton area of Northamptonshire. And because they appeared to be the bodies of four family members within their family home, as the senior detective for Northamptonshire, I was put on alert to go and oversee the inquiry.
The family were murdered at their home on Friday, the 29th of April last year. The bodies weren't discovered till late Sunday afternoon, early Sunday evening, on the 1st of May.
One step at a time, evidence is gathered. Amongst the first pieces of the picture of a killer to emerge as Timmins and his team began their investigation, the time of death. Friday afternoon. Science provided that information.
When you die, after about between two and four hours, you get this kind of stiffening of the muscles. It starts off in the face and the neck and these little muscles, and then it spreads to these bigger muscles. And what's happening is a kind of chemical process in the muscle fibres where they're becoming cross-linked and stiff and rigid. That rigor mortis, that stiffness, will be maintained for about 2 days, after which the muscle fibres begin to disintegrate and then they become floppy again. So you can use the stiffness of different parts of the body to get some sort of estimation of how much time has elapsed.
Establishing time of death was a straightforward enough conclusion for pathologists. For detectives, a range of theories now had to be considered. One immediately occurred to the lead investigator.
Your first reaction is, well, you know, do we have a murder or do we have some kind of murder-suicide, which, you know, does happen from time to time.
This, however, was not a case of murder-suicide. That was a theory soon dismissed. For it to be the case, the body of one of the four dead would offer no signs of having struggled.
I think we reached that conclusion fairly quickly because of the positions that the victims were found in, and it was clear that there had been a very violent struggle and both the adult victims had been murdered as opposed to having a struggle between themselves. So it was clear fairly quickly that we were dealing with a third-party murderer.
What about the nationality and culture of the victims? Investigators would learn that revenge, always a possible motive in any murder inquiry, is one which has a long history in Chinese society, where loss of face has been known to lead to vendettas against whole families. Was that what was behind the killer's actions? Was he taking revenge on an entire family for having lost face over something?
In Chinese culture, there is a point where, oh, yes, OK, I need to seek revenge in some way because he's done that to me, Ding has done that to me, therefore I need to sort of challenge that. I want him to lose face as well. He needs to do something about this family.
Sunday, May 1st, 2011, fell into two phases for the police. Before the discovery of the bodies, police in Northampton hear of an alert issued to all forces for a missing person, a Chinese national called Anziang Du. Du was the co-owner of this herbal medicine business in Birmingham, and he had not been heard from since calling into the store on the public holiday 2 days earlier.
We went into the shopping centre and left in the appointments book there a note to his family in Mandarin Chinese, which said things like eternal blessings and were clearly kind of phrases that thought he was not going to see them again.
He left a message for his wife, basically telling her, goodbye, I'm going. What he didn't really realise was that his wife would then contact the police to report him missing.
It was on the Saturday, the 30th, she'd gone to the shop that they owned in Birmingham and found what appeared to be a suicide note. In actual fact, when you read the note, it read more as a goodbye note than potentially a suicide note. But as it was, that's how the note was interpreted. And as such, Anziang Du was circulated by West Midlands Police quite rightly as a vulnerable missing person.
An alert goes to his local police force in the West Midlands saying, this man has gone missing, he's in an agitated state, we're worried about him. That missing persons alert in the West Midlands will go centrally, so the police in Northampton who are coming across this slaughtered family will also have that information that a man, a Chinese national, has gone missing and is in an agitated state.
A trawl of people who might know Anziang Du turned up the name of Jeff Ding.
It is quite common for the police to visit known associates of the missing person, and the Ding family were one of the few known associates of Anziang Du.
So, that Sunday morning of May 1st, an officer was sent to the Ding family home in an effort to find out if Mr. Du had been in touch with them.
The police were called that morning to visit the Ding family to see if they'd seen Du. And of course they knocked the door, got no reply early on a Sunday morning, nothing unusual in that, and left a calling card for them to contact police. Obviously, the officers, there is no way they could have known what was inside that quiet suburban house on a quiet, nice estate in a nice part of Northamptonshire.
Outside the house, no car. It was possible they were away. So, with their bodies inside, the officers attending the scene, oblivious to what had happened, left.
It is incredible, and I mean, you know, that there are occasions when this inquiry for me was marked more by extraordinary coincidences, missed opportunities, frustrations, barriers, than it was to, you know, normal detective work. I mean, it was literally a case of one step forward, two steps back.
Phase two of how police viewed events of May 1st, 2011 followed the eventual discovery of the bodies.
A neighbour of the Dings realises she hasn't seen the family about for a day, goes over and peers through the windows of their house and sees the carnage inside.
After the discovery of the bodies and the arrival of Murder Squad detectives on the case, it seemed too much of a coincidence. A Chinese family slaughtered on the day that a Chinese national, who knew them, is reported missing. The Dings had owned a Chinese herbal medicine business. Another Chinese national who owned a herbal medicine business was now officially a missing person. Why had the police in Birmingham assumed that the Dings would know anything about An Xiangdu? It turned out that An Xiangdu felt that he had plenty to be resentful about towards Jeff Ding. It wasn't always the case. The Ding and Du families went back a long time after the two women introduced their husbands to each other.
What we know is that Kan Cheng Du and Ji Shui Ding became friends, and as they were becoming friends, their husbands, obviously, they met each other.
Initially, they were friends and they went into business together to run a herbal medicine company.
And they, in fact, opened three of these shops, and things were looking good for them.
The then young professionals shared an expertise and worked hard.
And that was quite successful, and that represented that we're doing well financially and that they were quite proud of their businesses. That honour to them was quite what they represented. They can provide for their families, they can enjoy their lifestyle a bit more, because coming from mainland China, I'm sure they would have had quite hardships trying to find jobs, you know, trying to provide for themselves. So when they came over to Britain, this was an opportunity for success, you know, to be able to give their families the lifestyle that they probably didn't have when they were children.
However, disputes soon emerged between the business partners.
That relationship went sour when An Xiangdu was asked to leave the business by the Dings because of allegations of financial irregularity.
There were no charges, no police involvement, but it was the first hint that something was going wrong. And then 3 years later, in 2004, the Dues were dismissed from the partnership.
Things were to turn ugly. A complex dispute ended up in court.
Du and his wife started legal proceedings against the Dings on the basis they thought they'd been unfairly thrown out of their business partnership.
With the court procedures, at the start, they were quite in favour of the Dues. But as time progressed, the ruling was in favour of the Dings. And that meant for Du, it was really spiralling out of control. And there was no hope, really, for him to go anywhere to start a business or, you know, just to find the financial means to support his family.
And at the end of that battle, it was the Dings and not the Dues that succeeded.
The feud which had developed between the two families caused An Xiangdu's bitterness to run deep. He now faced paying £88,000 in legal fees. A complex financial arrangement meant that the house the Dings were now living in was part of the business's assets. Du hoped to sell the house in the village of Wotton, Northamptonshire. It would help him pay off his legal costs. But Du did not actually own it. A court order was issued, preventing Du from trying to sell the house.
Effectively, it froze the assets until the court made its determination, but effectively it meant that Mr. Du had no access to his financial assets, and the sale of his house was prevented.
That order was issued the day before the murders. Detectives had their motive.
Who would want to kill these people? Why would they be killed like this? And because of the legal case and because of the bitterness and the rancour that was around the splitting up of their business, Du would be the obvious suspect.
I mean, clearly the delivery of the court restraining orders the night before had effectively pushed him over the edge in terms of anger, rage, the need to hit back. And I suspect that he spent most of that night thinking about it, ruminating about it, building it up in terms of bile, anger, the need for revenge and retribution. And by the time he went to work on that Friday morning, I'm as convinced as I can be that he had murder in mind, that was his objective.
In any culture, what had happened to An Xiang Du would cause deep resentment. Some commentators on Chinese culture suggest a violent reaction was all but inevitable.
On one side, you've got the financial difficulties because now he's trying to find another job.
Du had lost this court case. He was in a huge amount of debt.
But more importantly is the loss of face. Obviously, because it's all about pride and how one holds themselves in the Chinese culture, when something turns as sour as that, it's almost as if your whole world has turned upside down.
There was, to An Xiang Du, a lot to be angry about. Two motive boxes were ticked.
There are a couple of things that come up in murder cases as common motives. One of them is, a big one, is revenge. So, you know, he wanted revenge. It's something like 3% of homicide cases in this country have a financial motive. 40% of them, the motive is it's either an argument or a struggle or it's a revenge attack.
We very quickly were able to examine the background of the association between the Ding family and An Xiang Du and establish this court battle that had been ongoing. So very, very quickly we were able to pinpoint Du as the likely murder suspect.
Displaying a motive to kill so obviously had betrayed Du as the prime suspect. Police quickly put out appeals for information.
Extensive forensic examination of the scene took place late Sunday and into Monday, the 2nd of May, all day Monday the 2nd of May. This led to us naming An Xiang Du as the prime suspect in this case on Tuesday, the 3rd of May.
The court case, which had so enraged An Xiang Du, involved a third party, someone who had become involved in the business. Was he now at risk?
We didn't know where this murderer had gone. Clearly wasn't still at the scene. And obviously, your determination at the outset of any homicide inquiry is to bring the offender to justice. But this was clearly something completely out of the ordinary, if I can use such a term for homicide.
Where was An Xiang Du? What mistake had he made to lead police to him and to prove he was a killer? And would he kill again? Within hours of the discovery of the murdered Ding family, police begin a painstaking trawl through digital evidence. They needed to find him, but also to build a case, and they would uncover plenty of sightings.
The UK is one of the most highly watched places in the world. There's vast numbers of CCTV cameras which have been put up by the police, by local authorities, by private businesses, and increasingly private individuals are installing CCTV cameras. So there's estimated to be more than, I think, somewhere between 4 and 6 million CCTV cameras in the UK.
Police were able to watch step by step Du's activities before the slaughter at Pioneer Close. His mistakes began the moment that he left his home on the day of the murders.
He hadn't really thought through the possibilities as to how he might be caught because he didn't really take any precautions.
The timeline of movement for Aung San Suu began on the Friday at about 10 o'clock-ish. He drove to Coventry Railway Station.
From Coventry, he bought a ticket to get him to his shop in Birmingham. Cameras, gathering information every second. He headed to his store, Natural Care in Birmingham.
It appears that he wasn't in the shop for very long, that he gathered a rucksack and wrote this goodbye note to his wife.
He picks up a bag which contains a knife.
It was the murder weapon.
And within a matter of minutes, left the shop, went to Birmingham New Street and started that fateful journey via train to Northampton, transferring at Northampton to the bus station.
Again, he was captured on camera. The journey from Birmingham to Northampton ended at 12:37. There, he soon found a bus that would take him to Wootton, the village where the Dings lived. On the bus, he appeared perfectly normal to other passengers, just someone else on a bus ride. During the journey, he changed seats. As he alighted, an issue to overcome. He was in the right village, but where was the house?
He doesn't know the area, he gets lost, he asks for directions from a driver, he's given directions, but they're wrong as well. So there's quite a bit of to-ing and fro-ing.
He would arrive at the house around 3 o'clock. The fate of the Ding family was sealed.
The last thing that he expects is his former partner, former business partner, is coming uninvited to his house, intent on revenge. But that's what happens. Aung San Suu comes into the kitchen.
Later, Aung San Suu would claim he was met with more provocation.
Ding laughed at Suu and called him a fool. That is almost like public shaming. It is, you know, one of the worst things that you can probably do in Chinese culture because you're shaming them in front of everyone.
He confronts Jeff Ding, produces his knife and attacks him.
Mrs. Ding seems to have been attacked just outside of the kitchen.
Du turns his attention onto her, again stabs her multiple times.
And then he ran upstairs to attack the daughters, who were cowering in a bedroom.
Aung San Suu went upstairs in that house, found two young girls cowering on a bed.
They're trying to summon help. But Du goes upstairs, finds them, and attacks them both. Stabs them both again, multiple times, again concentrating on the area of the body where he knows the vital organs are, intending to kill them. And he does. He kills both the girls. So within a matter of minutes, he's slain the entire family, mother, father, and both daughters.
The parents' bodies were found hidden behind a curtain downstairs, so they'd obviously been moved. The daughters were found upstairs in their bedrooms. One of the daughters was curled up in a ball.
Du's mind, previously entirely dominated by a lust to kill, now turned to covering his tracks.
Du's quite calm and collected.
Having murdered the family in cold blood, he washed the murder weapon, a knife, and his hands, and left it at the sink.
Having first slept after the murders, Du now plots his escape.
What he found was Jeff Ding's wallet and car keys, and decided, well, that's the means by which I'm going to make my escape.
The Ding car, one they had hired, was conspicuous by its absence when a police officer had visited. It was not there because Aung San Suu had taken it. It seems likely he waited until dark and left Pioneer Close sometime after 8:30 on April 29th. He then headed for a motorway.
The last sighting was at junction 8A of the M40, which is some miles distant of London, so he could have gone pretty much anywhere on that motorway. We were reliant on finding the stolen Vauxhall Corsa.
Dew's escape was haphazard but successful. He heads south and gets lucky as he drives into London by using a route where there were no cameras capable of automatic number plate recognition. He went undetected, for now.
The car was abandoned in a side street, this Venables Street, and we've got grainy CCTV at about 2:30 in the morning of someone matching Hang Xiang Du's description, walking along and looking into a shop front as he leaves the car behind.
The illegally parked car gets ticketed again and again and again over 9 days. Du once again got lucky. There is a nationwide hunt for him and for the car that he was driving, but none of the traffic wardens call the vehicle in to be towed away. If they had, it would have alerted police to its whereabouts and given them hope of finding Du.
Incredibly, perhaps, the car is parked in London and tracks 9 parking tickets, but nobody manages to connect the fact that this car is the one that was being used by the wanted man.
This case highlights a flaw in the system. You'd expect that if a car has been parked on a stretch of road and amassed 9 parking tickets over a series of days, that might flag up something to the local authority, that there may be a problem with this car. Maybe it's been stolen and abandoned. Maybe something has happened to the owner, because otherwise, how come they haven't come back and moved their car to stop them getting more parking tickets? That red flag wasn't raised, and maybe if it had, they might have got more information sooner.
The apparent abandon shown by Hang Xiang Du meant that the police were getting reports from people who'd seen him on public transport.
We have had over 380 suspect sightings. The majority of those sightings have been in the UK, and all of those sightings are dealt with under a very strict process to make sure we get the optimum from those sightings.
In fact, Hang Xiang Du had got lucky for a third time. He boards a ferry for France and is again not spotted.
He makes that journey across to France, he makes his way down through France, into Spain, and eventually gets the ferry from Algeciras across to Tangiers.
Hang Xiang Du goes off-grid in Morocco. He's living there under a false name, getting what work he can.
His luck just keeps on coming.
Once he's in Morocco, Du's actually arrested. He's arrested on suspicion of being there illegally. And he's released. This is only 5 days after the murders. But he's released because he claims his name is Li Ming, that he's from Taiwan, and he's allowed to stay. And he goes on to get a job. He ends up working as a night watchman on a construction site, and he had nowhere to live. He was sleeping sort of rough in the construction site. And some of the other workers kind of took pity on him and would give him food and so forth because they thought his life was so poor. But he was still free. He'd managed to escape.
Du had made a series of mistakes as he had set off to murder his victims. The trail of evidence from his front door to the house where he had killed, together with the clear motive that he had, was likely to get police a conviction. But within weeks of the murders, he was 2,000 miles away, living almost rough, with a new name, a new job, a new life. Police, meanwhile, were ramping up their appeals for help.
The Ding family had been in the UK since about late 1990. Jeff was working at Manchester University as a lecturer. Helen working locally at a school in Northampton, and with the children involved in education in Northampton as well. Since around 2002, both Jeff and Helen had been involved in a civil dispute with a Chinese family over a business issue.
They knew who they were looking for and why he had killed. What would be the mistake to ensure that the police would catch a killer? Detecting who had killed the Ding family had not taken long. Hang Xiang Du had hardly tried to cover his tracks.
I think by then, my personal opinion is that he set his mind on a course of action, and he was blind to everything else.
In the months which followed the murders, police knew they would need all the help they could get, and they travelled far and wide.
Our visit to China had three specific aims. These were to brief the Ministry of Public Security, which are essentially the Chinese police in Beijing, and inform them of the inquiry, the work we've undertaken today, and also to seek their assistance for further inquiries.
Unbeknownst to police, Du's haphazard escape plan had worked. But he was not in China, he was in North Africa, free, but facing the indignity of sleeping on a construction site, living on handouts.
I think Du would have found that humiliating, you know, on a makeshift bed and having food parcels, because he's so used to having his business, being able to provide for his family, and his lifestyle has drastically changed, you know, being able to provide for his family, having the means to go out and socialise with people, and for him to be isolated in Morocco, for him to have almost the food parcels given to him and sleeping on the makeshift bed, that's such a different lifestyle for Du that he's just not used to.
He cut an unmistakable figure, and it was this which was to be his undoing. His image had been captured by cameras throughout the English Midlands. It had taken time, but his getaway car had been found in London. It was hard to miss the face of An Xiang Du.
An Xiang Du becomes the most wanted person on the Crime Stoppers website. He's, you know, it's imperative for the police to find him as soon as possible. This is a man who's killed four people already, and there's a danger there. He circulates internationally because it's feared that he might have gone abroad.
I have to accept that An Xiang Du may have left the UK. We still look for him within the UK, but he may have left the UK possibly soon after the murders. Someone must have assisted him and is likely to be still assisting him or aware of where he is. I emphasise we've now increased the reward to £25,000, which is a substantial award, and we're looking for that information to come to us directly as the investigation team or through Crime Stoppers.
And that was how Du would be caught. As sightings stopped, it became clear that he'd got out of Britain. His profile, so easy to publicise using the images captured on surveillance, made for headline news and international Crime Stopper programmes.
I should also stress that today we've had no confirmed sightings of An Xiang Du anywhere in the world. This is one reason why I've fully utilised the Crime Stoppers structure, for example, throughout the UK, Europe, and lately North America, to highlight to as wide an audience as possible.
The availability of Du's image made it easier to spread the word.
What he doesn't realise is that Spanish TV has a programme quite similar to Crime Watch in the UK, and they cover the case, and his photo is put onto Spanish TV, and then someone recognises him in Morocco.
In July 2012, so some 14 months after the murders, the man who runs the building site and employs him as night watchman realises that his night watchman is actually An Xiang Du, the wanted quadruple murderer from the UK. He tells the police Du is arrested in Morocco when he is finally brought back to the UK and charged with the murder of the four members of the Ding family.
Killers who are captured have always made at least one mistake. Du was first reported to police by his own wife, anxious at seeing a note showing Du in despair. Was that his biggest mistake?
The letter was obviously the precursor to An Xiang Du being treated as what we call a vulnerable missing person. What that did was elevate his status as a missing person to one of a high priority. So the very fact that he was identified as potentially being vulnerable through what appeared to be a suicide threat meant that the police would make immediate active inquiries to trace his whereabouts. And it was those immediate active inquiries to trace his whereabouts that provided the vital link between our murders and the missing person inquiry.
Or was the killer's mistake the trail that he left, which made it easy for detectives to know who the killer was?
I think Du's biggest mistake was not realising the extent of surveillance in this country. Once you become a person of interest, The police can then go back and look at the CCTV footage, and they can find images of you everywhere. There were images of him travelling by train. There were images of him on a bus towards the victim's house. Then once he steals their car, there's the automatic number plate recognition cameras that are picking up where that vehicle is travelling.
Virtually everything he did on the day of the murders and the day after were recorded, and police were able to go back to and piece together his entire route.
Once you become a person of interest, you are watched and there are photos of you everywhere, and it was really those photos and those images which helped convict him.
For lead detective Glyn Timmons, the context of An Xiang Du's murders make him amongst the worst killers that he has come across.
When you talk about evil, you talk about pre-planning, you talk about those elements that somebody has deigned that you were going to die. I don't think it was evil from that point of view, because this was blind rage.
Why had he done it? His argument had been with Jeff Ding and his wife, but surely not the children.
You might wonder why Du killed the whole of the Ding's family and not just Ding himself.
What was more important to him was getting the revenge that he felt was due for the wrong that had been done to him and to his family.
It's really because the way that the Chinese culture works. We talked about losing face in the family name, and for Du, Ding has taken everything away from him. Therefore, Du not only has to kill Ding, but he has to kill everyone associated with the Ding name. So that includes his wife and the two children.
Not something a hard-nosed detective finds easy to take.
Nothing will ever reconcile me to the mentality of somebody who goes up to a child's bedroom, finds two innocent young people cowering on a bed, having slain their parents. They're in terror, and then that person goes setting about them with a knife, stabbing them repeatedly in front of each other to take their lives. That is malevolent, that is evil. There is no way that I can ever come to terms with that. It just defies every belief I hold dear. It's inconceivable.
In 2013, An Xiang Du argued in court that he was guilty only of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. He had lost control. His defence was rejected by a jury, and he was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 40 years behind bars. He will be 94 when he is eligible for release.